the version you have doesn't have all the pictures in it. I just put in a couple because they don't reproduce very well anyway in black and white. But I can have this floating around the room if anybody wants to take a look at it. So what he does, he's writing these, what are referred to as illuminated books, books that he's got poetry in, narrative, and pictures, and he's doing these and printing these himself in his little engraving shop. And my argument that I make in my book on this subject, here's the advertisement for this, it's in the bookstore at the Holden Bookstore, is that Blake's series of works that he produces are each targeting one of the wisdom books of the Bible and are responding to one in particular and rewriting it. And his whole frame of thought is that the Bible has been corrupted by years of bad theology, which you need to see your way through, and even more than that, by bad editors, which a lot of people today would agree with as the translations get better, but that bad editing has produced a corrupt text that needs to be uncorrupted before you can make sense of it. So what he's doing in these is uncorrupting the text. At least that's one of the things that he thinks he's doing. So he's particularly thinking about lots of things, but the biblical wisdom connection is the one that I'm focusing on. And I talked last time about the definition of the word parable. Much of what he's doing in here is writing little stories, parables. And the word parable means, literally, to throw beside. To throw one thing beside another, to make a comparison in the Greek is really what it is. So the kingdom of heaven is like, Jesus says, well, what should I compare to? A mustard seed. So you'll put one thing beside another and you see what happens. And in a sense, that's what Blake is doing. He's throwing his books and his proverbs beside the books of the Bible, and he wants you to compare them and to see what happens. So that's exactly what we'll do today. I've got some slides and lined up some of Blake's proverbs, lined up specifically with some of the proverbs out of the book of Proverbs, so that we can do what he's asking us to do, is see the relationship, to see how he's targeting and what he's doing in his response. One other way of talking about, in general terms, what I'm focusing on today is that it's the connection of wisdom and prophecy. So Blake's works are interested in wisdom, but he's also a prophetic writer. I like to think that those two types of speech, that is wisdom and prophecy, are characteristic of me. So that when I'm lecturing to my students, I'm fairly wise and I'm fairly prophetic. Now most of that type of discourse, whether it's biblical or not, is not meant to have much of a sense of humor. If you think someone's dishing out wisdom to you, for the most part it's serious stuff. And if someone's giving you prophetic critiques of what's going wrong, it's not very funny either. And yet Blake does have a sense of humor. I think he's a rare prophet in that respect. Maybe other prophets have a sense of humor, but lots of the ones I've seen don't. Just talking about sort of lack of humor, maybe that's more characteristic of people in my profession than wisdom and prophecy, but just reminds me of a story. This is the requisite joke that one must begin with, okay? This guy goes back to his alma mater, his campus that he had graduated from 25 years ago. And he's looking around feeling nostalgic because the place has changed enough and he doesn't see a single person he knows, so he's feeling sort of lost. And across the quad, he sees coming a familiar face. He recognizes him. It's his economics professor. So he runs up to him. He's finally found some connection to this community he was once part of. And he runs up and he shakes the professor's hand. He says, "Hello, Dr. Smith. I had you for an economics class 25 years ago. And the professor says, grades are final. So I haven't got to that point, I don't think, quite yet. It gets close. Anyway, I want to start with a couple snippets of things. This is multimedia presentation, at least as multimedia as I get. There's handouts. And did everybody end up with one? Or at least have one within view? Anybody back need some?
We even have an extra.
Okay. So, I'd like to start. I guess I need a copy of myself. Start with what Blake always starts with, whether he's writing Proverbs or anything else, and that's with a myth. He thinks in terms of stories, myths, parables, narratives. I mean, even when he's rewriting wisdom books, which we think of as not being very narrative, they're lists of proverbs. But the book of Proverbs itself has narrative sections to it, and Blake's works have narratives too. And just to help summarize some of the things I've already said, but to put this in perspective, I'd like to take a look at one of his myths. And the fun thing about Blake is, and the confusing thing, is you can't ever summarize and say, know this, this, and this, and then you'll get it. Because his whole method is one of hating systematic keys, single answers, because he feels that's always bonking you over the head with the truth. And the way to experience truth is to go to God directly, as any good visionary seer will do. So I can say there are central myths, there are central ways that he looks at the Bible, he looks at the world, but you can't say this is the truth. So he'll read the Bible in that fashion, he'll read Genesis as itself one version of the way things happen, but not the only version. So what it means is, I mean, lots of people, the way they read Blake is you have to know all these weird figures that he invents, and it gets you baffled fairly quickly, and learn all these names and learn the system. I mean, and I'm not terribly interested in that, because he changes it as soon as you turn the page. So you don't have to remember it. Part of the point is the energetic involvement in the reading. But in spite of that, one of his key myths is that at the fall, he's preoccupied with the fall and redemption, I mean, basic Christian themes. At the fall, picture this, the world for him, I mean, he's thinking in poetic terms, is flat. We're walking around on this flat earth. At the fall, the world turns upside down. So think Adam and Eve here, and he'll think about them sometimes, and sometimes he'll think about other figures that he just gives names to. But even Adam, eat the apple, the world turns upside down. And now they're walking around on their heads, as we are today, as is anyone who has fallen. And at that moment, then, people are confused, because what we think of as up is really down. And from that moment on, in his view, or at least one of his views, organized religion worships the wrong God. That God up there now isn't God, that's Satan. And organized religions that worship that God can't understand the truth and will never get to redemption. And the real God isn't a sky God then, it's Jesus for Blake. It's ultimately always Jesus. Now, just one place, just that quickly brings that into focus, it's not in perfect clarity because nothing in Blake is this other sort of perfectly clear. But if you just flip in this that I've given you to plate 5, and you can see, I mean, it just is listing plates here, and it's on page 34 if you're looking at the bottom for page numbers. This is one quick expression of that concept of the world being upside down. I'll show you some slides about that, and then we'll get on to the Proverbs. Plate 5. I mean, it's hard to even say what this thing is, that this marriage of heaven and hell is. It's not just one thing, but ultimately what he's doing is he's spawning the book of Proverbs. But here he's telling this quick little story. Plate 5, he says, those who restrain desire, are you with me? Those who restrain desire do so because theirs is weak enough to be restrained. And that's bad for him. And the restrainer, or reason, and Blake is writing at the end of the 18th century, and many of the changes that are going on in the late 18th century, which give us modern industrial society, he can't stand. It's one of the reasons why I like him so much, too. He's a real early critic of materialism, of deism, secular religion. He sees that going on and as a product of economic changes taking place, and he can't stand it. I mean, the deadening of humanity and spirituality. So, I mean, here he's labeling all that as reason. Reason's bad if reason takes over, and desire is good. So he goes on and says, and being restrained, it by degrees becomes passive till it is only the shadow of desire. The history of this is written in Paradise Lost. So he's thinking about Milton's Paradise Lost, which is the grand epic story of the fall of Satan from heaven and the creation of Adam and Eve and the redemption through God's plan. So here Blake is saying that story is summarized in this little comment about reason and desire, which is not a normal, necessarily, way to read the story of Paradise Lost, but it's one way to read it. And he goes on to say, the history of this is written in Paradise Lost, and the governor, or reason, is called Messiah. And there's the key. The bad guy in the story of Paradise Lost is the Messiah. Now, so what he's talking about, the world's upside down. Milton's Paradise Lost, even though he loves Milton and Milton is an inspired writer, and you can read Paradise Lost if you read it correctly to find the vision at the heart of it, but Milton himself was confused when he was justifying the ways of God to man, as he says at the beginning of Paradise Lost. He was justifying the ways of this, I mean, you could think of it in these terms, Old Testament law-giving master blaster who only oppresses people. And Blake says, I mean, the true God is this Jesus figure. So there's that sort of upside-down world. This is all meant to clarify things at the beginning. If it doesn't, I wouldn't worry too much. But that's something I always say. It'll be clear. I mean, don't worry if it's not clear. It'll become clear someday. Before the final exam, maybe. And the original archangel or possessor of the command of the heavenly host is called devil or Satan, and his children are called sin and death. So the world, and Milton calls Satan, and sin and death bad guys, but they're really good guys. But in the book of Job, Milton's Messiah is called Satan, he says. So the Bible's got some things right. And he says, for this history has been adopted by both parties. And this is where, I mean, it gets a little bit confusing. Things are upside down, but it's not all perfect inverses of things. But as he goes on to say, it appeared to reason as if desire was cast out. So now he's just summarizing what he said. Here's the story, the way Milton tells it, and the way organized Christian religions sort of have received it. So, and this is partly with Blake's translation. So it appeared to reason, rational religion, as if desire, satanic desire, was being thrown out of heaven, and you get religion which says, don't do that, don't touch that, with all the sexual restraint that Blake doesn't like. But the devil's account is, think about the upside-down world. Now, the devil is his good term here. God's real account of what happened is that the Messiah fell and formed a heaven of what he stole from the abyss. So that's Jesus falling out of heaven at the fall, because at the fall, the world turns upside down, and Jesus is falling out of the hearts of people somewhere else, becoming separated from people. This is shown in the gospel where Jesus prays to the Father to send the comforter or desire that reason may have ideas to build on, the Jehovah, the Bible, becoming none other than he who dwells in flaming fire. Then know that after Christ's death, he becomes Jehovah. And there's this weird timeline going on here. I mean, this isn't sort of linear time that Blake is even thinking of, and I didn't want to try to explain that. But in Milton, the Father is destiny, the Son, a ratio of the five senses, and the Holy Ghost, vacuum. So he's saying, in Milton, the Trinity is this anti-humanistic, institutionalized religion that only leads to the death of the soul. It will never lead to redemption. Now, if that sounds rather strange, the thing to keep in mind is that the Bible has been in the hands of people who worship the wrong God, not the true Jesus, not the true Christian God. It needs to be reread through those eyes. And that's what he's going to do when he's writing his Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And Just a few slides to illustrate that, what he's got on his mind. Just a couple of quick illustrations. This is a picture of Moses erecting the rod of the brazen serpent on it. Some of you know that story. The only reason I'm putting this in here is just Moses, for Blake, was a visionary prophet, but he too, because he's the great lawgiver, law receiver, is receiving the Ten Commandments, which are then used to bonk people over the heads. So even though he was a visionary, he was thinking about the wrong God at times. And so here's Blake taking the passage, thinking about the serpent here as being sort of the wrong God, taking over the vision and being responsible for the Ten Commandments. So Blake's got a rereading of the Ten Commandments and about Jesus' response to the Ten Commandments that is in the Marriage, Heaven, Hell. You might be able to take a quick look at, but there's a couple other quick ones. This is Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel post-restoration. That's why it's so bright. Creation of Eve. We recognize that. The creation of Adam is the more familiar one. But there's Adam sleeping. So this is from Genesis 1 or 2, where she comes out of his rib.
Two.
Okay. So there she is. And you see God over there. There's the image of God. Now, Blake, image of God, the God that he likes, usually is Jesus, the young man. Now here's Blake's version of the creation of Eve. What's different? Lots different. What's the key difference you see there?
Jesus.
Yeah. Jesus is creating Eve, not this old man. And for Blake, that old man is part of his iconography of the wrong God. That's the Old Testament Yahweh, and he likes Jesus. So he depicts Jesus, the one creating him here. What else have I got? What Blake is after then, as the title of his Marriage of Heaven and Hell indicates, is there's Adam and Eve before the fall in an embrace, and Satan's above watching them, lurking around. But there's, like the illustration in the front of the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, the title page which you've got in your handout, that type of human marriage where male and female are together, where heaven and hell are together, and he's always thinking symbolically, the body and the soul need to be together. When you bring those together, that's the heart of Christian religion to Blake. When you separate body and soul, or reason and energy, when you separate anything, which he would argue is what organized religion always does, it can't not do that. So, it's an incarnation theology that Blake has. That's the proper way to view things. One way that this ties into the book of Proverbs, last time we were looking briefly at some of the framing myths in the biblical book of Proverbs, is some of the late mythic development there that talks about God and wisdom, and personifies wisdom as this feminine deity that's the ancient consort of God, that she's the one that speaks the wisdom in the book of Proverbs. This is in chapters 1 through 9. She's the one that speaks that wisdom. She's this ancient consort that God created, but that becomes his partner. Blake loves that frame, that myth, and so that's the marriage of heaven and hell too. God and God's consort, wisdom, when they're together, regeneration can take place. When they're separated, when God is separated from wisdom, that is a definition of the fall. And one of the other myths that Blake constantly is working with and retelling the story is about what happens at the fall. It's not just Eve eating from the apple, but God is separated from his ancient consort, Lady Wisdom, and turns her instead from his bride into a temple harlot. And then, this is tied in Blake's mind. He's got a real cross-cultural, mythological view of things. So look at Greek myth, and all the Greek sort of temple harlots that are associated with some of their worship systems. And he sees that as the consequence of God being separated from wisdom. If that sounds strange too, you're thinking, this guy is so nutty, I don't think I want to believe any of his proverbs. Suspend disbelief a little bit, and we'll take a look at some of his wisdom, and see if there is, I mean, something there or not. And by that I mean, is there something in Blake and this radical Christian view that can be of any benefit for contemporary Christians? So, what you're looking at then is Blake's Marriage, Heaven, and Hell. That's the title plate for it. And it's an illuminated book, so he's got text and pictures. And I'm just going to flash these so you. So this is the real thing up here. This is what the thing looks like. So you just have a text then. And the two really do go together.
Was this printed, or was this just an original manuscript?
Etched. So he copper plates.
There's only one copy, or they made.
He printed each one is an original. Marriage, Heaven, Hell, there's 10 copies that they found. So he wasn't making bunches of these things. And each one is different. There's another one, the idiosyncrasies. Everyone has to be quite different from the other one, so they're all original. Anyway, I'm just flashing through this so you can get a feeling for sort of the color of the thing. So,
Blake's sort of an artist as well.
Yeah, I mean, he made his living as an engraver. And, I mean, not a great living, but a decent living, but you can imagine. I mean, someone with his imagination, they'd ask him to illustrate a book. He'd do the design and give it to him, and they'd say, what is this? It's got a thing floating in the sky. This is a story about a boy and a dog. What's this new monster? Well, that's how I read the story. So, what I've got here, once I make the switch, is the switch to the Proverbs.
How did the church, I mean, in those days, the church was pretty fussy about such things. How did they treat him?
I mean, he wasn't that well known in his life. He's hanging around with some of the radicals like Tom Paine, Mary Wollstonecraft. But when he's got 10 copies of these things that the collectors are buying, it's just not much to worry about.
Well, if 10 survive, can we believe that he printed dozens or hundreds, or is it really more like 10 that he, in your estimation?
No, he didn't print many. I mean, they know more or less how many he printed. Like, some of his other ones are 20 copies.
So he wasn't making any money on this stuff?
No. On his poetry, he wasn't making it. Oops, I put it wrong.
So we have to lie down on the rug now? Is that it?
Yeah.
16 chapters.
Lie down, right.
So what I want to do now, and it's what I do in my book, is look at then, I mean, to throw his Proverbs, his book, beside the Book of Proverbs, which is Blake showing you how to read the Bible. And, I mean, it's a training course in how to read. And as I said, some of the earlier studies, this makes Blake sound like a real Gnostic. That is, you have to learn this weird system, this weird secret system, before you can unlock the keys to the mystery of divine religion. But Gnosticism really, in some sense, is the farthest thing from Blake's view. He hates Gnostics. I mean, the gospel message is as clear as it is to Paul, and as simple as it is to Paul. I mean, stated in the Holden Summer theme. I mean, God is calling everyone to the feast. And you don't need systems, you don't need anything to understand that. But Blake is simply saying that itself is a big mystery, and let's just deal with that in all its aesthetic, artistic, mythic ramifications and keep telling that story over and over in different ways. So, last time we looked in detail at the Book of Proverbs, and tomorrow, Saturday, I'm going to talk about his response to Ecclesiastes, which is, Job, and then next week I'm going to do Ecclesiastes. His response to Job is wonderful.
But this is interesting, too. I mean, these are some of the basic characteristics of the Book of Proverbs for quick comparison. Book of Proverbs, the central biblical wisdom book, is an articulation of order. Biblical wisdom, I mean, basic characteristic, the world is an orderly place. In fact, you read any of the Proverbs in the Book of Proverbs, that's all they say. God, if God exists, and God does, then the law of distributive justice will be in effect. In an orderly world, you'll get what you deserve. If you're good, you'll be rewarded. If you're bad, you will be punished. So rotten people on this earth will be punished. And constantly, that's what the Book of Proverbs is articulating this vision of. I mean, the other half of biblical wisdom tradition is the response to the inadequacies of that. So you get Job and Ecclesiastes saying, how can that be true? I mean, I look around me and rotten people have money and good people don't. Does that mean there is no God, or what can it mean? So those are the two sides of biblical wisdom. Book of Proverbs, though, is confident, it's conservative, it's articulating law and order, and its chief literary form is a binary proverb. It is two-part proverbs, two versets, two sentences, and it draws them together, I mean, in the Hebrew, in a poetic fashion, so there's some real artistry going on. And I don't do Hebrew, but then neither did Blake, so that doesn't matter. But you can see there's an example of a binary proverb. A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. So the two parts are the parts before and after the punctuation. So you get a first sentence and then a response. And there's three relationships between the versets in the biblical proverbs. Equivalence, elaboration, is where the first sentence says something, and the second one gives you some more details about it. Antithesis is the most common one. The first sentence says something, and the second one corrects it. So the example there, the rod and reproof give wisdom. I'm going through this fast because I want to get to play. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but. So there's the comparison, the antithesis. But a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. And the third type of proverb in the Book of Proverbs is a riddle. The first sentence gives you an image that you're meant to ponder, second half explains it. So, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. What does that mean? Let's think about that. The righteous runneth into it and is safe. There's the answer. So, the grammatical summary definition of how biblical proverbs, and really all proverbs that function as proverbs, can be thought of, they're affirmative utterances. And this is a jargon term, you could say, but I think it's useful jargon. I mean, it's a linguistic term. An affirmative utterance gets its meaning not from an individual speaker. So if I'm dishing out wisdom to you now and I'm just inventing, it's not quite a proverb. It's not bringing up this whole tradition. But it gets its force, its authority in a culture by summarizing collective experience. So that's the Book of Proverbs. Now, Blake's response is to write in front of you the whole Marriage, Heaven, and Hell, but in particular, his list of proverbs in there, which are called the Proverbs of Hell. And if you can just flip to that page in there, it's near the, I think you're already on the page, actually. Page 35, down near the bottom, all of a sudden there's a list of proverbs of hell. You see that? And what he does, he's been telling you stories, and then he's telling you about this upside-down world, and then he says, okay, here's some proverbs. And just the introduction to that, on page 35, let's just quickly read. How are we doing for time? He says, as I was walking among the fires of hell, so he's just telling you that Satan in hell, and this is a basic romantic view of Satan anyway, Wordsworth and Shelley and some others like this. So the speaker here is, I was walking as this devil who is therefore true wisdom. As I was walking among the fires of hell, delighted with the enjoyment of genius, which to the angels look like torment and insanity. So again, when you're talking about the torments of hell, it's looked at from the wrong perspective, but it isn't torment. I collected some of their... any description of buildings or garments. So Milton in Paradise Lost had described hell. Instead, Blake is going to tell you some of their proverbs.
When I came home on the abyss of the five senses, where a flat-sided steep frowns over the present world, I saw a mighty devil folded in black clouds, hovering on the sides of the rock with corroding fires. He wrote the following sentence, now perceived by the minds of men and read by them on earth. And that's partly even a joke. I mean, he's saying, it's now read, and you're now reading it. I mean, there it is, and it's being etched in your mind. I mean, with this etching sort of pun he's got going. And here's the question. How do you know but every bird that cuts the air away is an immense world of delight closed by your senses five? The question of a visionary. I mean, how do you know that anything you see isn't a door to the apocalypse, to true enlightenment, that if we limit it to late 18th century science, Newtonian science, and what you can measure, taste, touch, and feel, you'll never find the God in it. So everything for Blake is a possibility for opening yourself up to vision. And he constantly was. He was walking down the street and seeing visions. I mean, lots of stories about him. Walk down, there's a tree, and poof, angels would be singing. So here's his list of Proverbs. And you can see that he's responding to biblical Proverbs. I've just got some pairs here. And what I'd like you to do is just look at some of these pairings, and I mean, the question I'd like to take up with the rest of the time is, what's Blake up to in these pairings? There's one out of Book of Proverbs, drink waters out of thine own cistern, let thy fountains be dispersed abroad. So Blake writes, the cistern contains, the fountain overflows. Now, I mean, these are, I mean, I'm lining these up. I mean, Blake doesn't ever say what he's responding to, but I mean, it's fairly obvious from these pairings that he's thinking about the Book of Proverbs. And what's the difference between those? Anybody? I mean, how would you characterize that?
What's the proverb mean?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a quick response to that. I mean, all the Proverbs in the Book of Proverbs really are saying good guys get rewarded, bad guys are punished. And the first five chapters are giving you this framework of sexual restraint, personifies lady wisdom, this ancient consort of God in this sort of quickie myth, and then Dame Folly is this street prostitute who's calling out to people with this false wisdom, and if you come into her, you're leaving the road to true wisdom and you're lost. And so many of the Proverbs are saying, stay with your wife of ancient days, don't leave her for the prostitute, because those ways lead to death. So there's sexual advice. I mean, and partly, I mean, this one's early, chapter 5, it's in that early frame when she's singing. So drink waters out of thy own cistern, and let thy fountains be dispersed abroad. I mean, it's partly just saying, stay with your home people, but you can also spread wisdom. And Blake writes, a cistern contains, the fountain overflows. I mean, it takes a number of these before you can start to extract what Blake is up to. I mean, and that's what I want to do. Here's, on the nature of wisdom, the Bible says, the Book of Proverbs, the knowledge of the holy is understanding. So if you know what's holy, you've got knowledge. Blake says, everything that lives is holy. So it's a more, I mean, it sounds like, you could say, more inclusive view. There's not people who are in and out in terms of whether you know something or whether you don't.
Well, the Proverbs sounds like Gnosticism.
All right.
You have to know it.
That's exactly. I mean, Blake's is a non-Gnostic proverb there. It's not knowledge that leads you to something. Here's some of the other basic forms of biblical proverbs. I mean, epigrammatic similes, as snow in summer and as rain in harvest, so honor is not seemly for a fool. Chapter 26, there's a bunch of those in a row. So you get these quick comparisons. And these are like the riddle ones. So as snow in the summer, so you don't have snow in the summer unless you live in Bozeman where I live. And as rain, it snowed Friday before we came here last week, as I said. As snow in summer and as rain in harvest, so honor is not seemly for a fool. So does that make sense?
Yeah, they don't come together.
Yeah. So, I mean, that makes perfect sense. It's kind of a riddle, but it explains it. Or another one, chapter 26, as the bird by wandering and as the swallow by flying, so the curse causeless shall not come.
A curse doesn't come unless there's a cause.
So, I mean, and that's in the book of Job, what Job's friends are constantly saying to Job. You're suffering here, buddy. And they're constantly quoting Book of Proverbs wisdom. You're suffering because you did something wrong. And you may not know it, but you did something wrong because God doesn't punish people who aren't evil. So they're constantly dishing out this wisdom to him, and he's crying out, I didn't do anything. I cursed the day I was ever born. Life isn't very fun anymore. And Blake has some similar form proverbs. And here's Blake's. As the air to a bird or the sea to a fish... You can see, I mean, he's thinking directly about these proverbs. So is contempt to the contemptible. I mean, that's fairly similar, actually. Now, my next sheet, I think this will start to make more sense, sort of the system behind, or the method behind his responses. I mean, this one really just shows you that he is thinking about the book of Proverbs. There's another one. A whip for the horse, a bridle for the ass, and a rod for the fool's back. There's Book of Proverbs. Wherever there's a parenthesis chapter, that's the Bible. So does that make sense? A whip for the horse, a bridle for the ass, and a rod for the fool's back?
Restraints.
Yeah. Restraint. I mean, that's really... And Blake's, the bird, a nest, the spider, a web, man, friendship.
That's
interesting. So you see, I mean, Blake's are all riddles. They're trying to get you to think in a little bit of weird fashion. Another word order inversion, riches profit not in the day of wrath. And all these kids running around today, including my daughter, who love to say some sentence and then say not. I mean, you've heard them all do this. I mean, here's the biblical source for that. Riches profit not in the day of wrath. And Blake's got prayers plow not, praises reap not. Now, there's some basic form. Now, I hope this will start to make some more sense. So what is he up to? Here's what Blake is up to. And there's a two-step process in how Blake reads anything. Blake is a contrarian enough that his only use for anything that he ever read was to refute it. He did a lot of reading, but he can't accept, I mean, as he says in one of his works, I must create my own system or be enslaved by another's. So you can't just buy Jungian philosophy and say, this is it. Or the Myers-Briggs, whatever they were talking about last night at the forum for a little while. I mean, personality types. I mean, if you chop things up into this little box and say, this is the way it is, and that's the way you see the world, that is always only oppression. You've got to keep doing things yourself. So, Blake's first response to anything is to satirize it and says, ha, you think you know what you're talking about? And he will criticize it. I mean, that's the great late 18th century, early 18th century literary form, satire. Think of Alexander Pope and any other 18th century boring poets you read back in college. Oops. Satire. So he'll satirize the Bible. That's his first step. But he's not satisfied with that because he's not just beating up on things. He wants to bring about redemption. And you don't bring about redemption just by criticizing things. So his next step will be to transform it. So here's the satire, and then we'll look at the transformation. And he'll satirize much about the Book of Proverbs. The definitions of wisdom in the Book of Proverbs, wisdom is defined as something external to yourself. And so it says, wisdom is too high for a fool. Or he that trusteth in his own heart is a fool. I mean, true wisdom comes from God. And Blake's response is, no bird soars too high if he soars with his own wings. So what's that saying? I don't know.
Trust your own capacities and don't be limited by boring proverbs.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's individuality. So, I mean, this you could translate Blake, and Blake was a favorite poet of 60s hippies. Anti-establishment. So wisdom, if you trust yourself, you're a fool to the Book of Proverbs. If you don't trust yourself, you're a fool to Blake. If you trust someone else, over 30 or anybody, you'll be a fool. So it's very much a wisdom of experience that Blake is talking about. On prudence here, Book of Proverbs at the opening part makes it very clear, so that you won't misunderstand any of the Proverbs, the wise in heart shall be called prudent. So all the advice in the Book of Proverbs is the proverb of prudence. And that much of the wisdom that follows, I mean, we would call it prudent too. And Blake's famous definition of prudence is a rich, ugly old maid courted by incapacity. I mean, and that's meant to be a joke, but I mean, it's a devastating attack on prudence. I mean, the only people who are prude or that follow sort of prudent advice are people who can't do anything else. And that's what he was saying in his little myth about desire and reason. Remember, those who restrain their desire is weak enough to be restrained. On instruction. This is the Bible. The Bible's full of advice on advice. How to learn. Take fast hold of instruction. Let her not go. Keep her, for she is thy life. So there's the feminine personification of wisdom and instruction. Spareth the rod, spoileth the child. We've all heard that one. The rod and the reproof give wisdom, but a child left himself brings his mother to shame. That one was on the other sheet. Blake's responses to instruction are what follows. The eagle never lost so much time as when he submitted to learn of the crow. Or the apple tree never asks the beech how he shall grow, nor the lion asks the horse how he shall take his prey. So to each his own individual wisdom is basically what Blake is saying there. You can't learn from another completely different species. You can't learn from someone else. If the fool would persist in his folly, he would become wise. That's Blake. So you learn by experience. You don't learn by someone telling you what to do. Now you can tie this into, again, if you wanted to historicize a lot of this, I mean, late 18th century education theory, Rousseau, Romanticism, I mean, a lot of this stuff is in the works about sort of how are we going to educate our kids. And I mean, a lot of people would have agreed with Blake within a couple decades. And if others had not been foolish, we would be so.
Well, that sounds like he's learning from other people.
Right. I mean, if you look for complete consistency in Blake, I mean, it's not completely, certainly. The chief image for the path of wisdom in the Bible, the way, or in the Book of Proverbs wisdom tradition, the way, the straight path. Stay on God's straight path. So it says, avoid the wicked whose ways are crooked. Blake says, improvement makes straight roads, but the crooked roads without improvement are roads of genius. So you can see what he's doing here. I mean, the satire, I mean, he's saying this stuff in the Bible is just dead wrong. And you just have to realize that the Bible's got some parts wrong. I mean, this ties into some of the discussion they're having about language last night. I mean, what do we do with parts of the Bible that Fred Niedner's been talking about? I mean, the hate speech in the Bible, what do we do with that? I mean, we're going to historicize some of that. We're going to say, well, that doesn't quite apply anymore. You know, and Blake is certainly wrestling with the same questions here. How do we treat parts of the Bible that we don't quite agree with? And, I mean, here's his training, and here's what you're going to do. Part of it, he's showing you, here's the parts that he doesn't like. On speaking, Book of Proverbs is constantly saying, shut up. Hold your tongue. Don't speak very much, because it's in silence and listening that you can learn wisdom. So you get, he that keepeth his mouth keepeth his life, but he that openeth wide his lips shall have destruction. Blake, one more biblical one. In the multitude of words there wanteth not sin. He said, the translation I've got up here is King James, because that's the one Blake used. In the multitude of words there wanteth not sin, but he that refraineth his lips is wise. So don't speak, biblical proverbs are saying. And the next one, I mean, this is prudent wisdom. Even if you're stupid, if you shut up, somebody might think you know something. And there's lots of folk versions of that proverb, but once you say something, they'll know you're dumb. And Blake repeats the same proverb with just a different attitude. The selfish smiling fool and the sullen frowning fool shall both be thought wise, that they may be a rod. He's basically saying the exact same thing. Stupid people hold their tongue, people think they're wise, and pretty soon they're the ones in charge. And this is early versions of Murphy's Laws, you could even say. On sexual restraint, Bible, Book of Proverbs, whoso committeth adultery with a woman lacketh understanding, he that doeth it destroyeth his own soul. Blake's response, the soul of sweet delight can never be defiled. I mean, he really is articulating, I mean, what from the 60s we call free love. Does human desire, I mean, it's a radical humanism too. Human, if God created us, not just our reason, but all aspects, then all of that is good. And desire is an expression of God's desire. So he's saying you can't ever defile that. And as he goes on to say, damn, the punctuation of this is interesting. Damn, period, braces, colon, bless, relaxes. So the Book of Proverbs is saying, restrain yourself. Blake is saying, don't restrain yourself.
But on your earlier sheet, he said, drink from your own sister. I like that one better.
Yeah, right.
Go out into the fountains. So he says the opposite here.
Yeah, I mean part of it depends specifically what he's responding to. Now, So Blake's
satirizing some of the Bible. That's partly what he's going to do. I mean, that was what's going on there.
But it won't stop there. What he wants to do is ultimately transform it.
And there's two aspects to that. I mean, one is he'll create his alternative version of the Book of Proverbs. That's what the marriage covenant of hell is. So he says, read this instead. But it's not really just an alternative version. What he wants you to do is go back to the Book of Proverbs and just read it differently. Now, he calls that infernal reading. So I want you to read the Bible differently. Just think about it with the world upside down for a minute, and you will read it differently. So part of what he'll do is he'll take biblical Proverbs and just rewrite them slightly, and then he'll go back and reread biblical Proverbs slightly. And once all that's done, you go back and read the Book of Proverbs, and pretty soon, instead of reading what you used to read, you'll start hearing Blake's voice in the biblical Proverbs. And some of his techniques for doing this are what gets real interesting. And I just want to get to those, so we won't do all those, I'll flash to a few. So, the law of distributive justice, again, at the heart of the Book of Proverbs, where the Book of Proverbs says you get what you deserve. That's a law that Blake doesn't like very much. I mean, that is a law that can be used to justify all kinds of things and has been. So the poor folks over there, we don't have to help them because God helps those who help themselves. And I mean, that's sort of some of the implication of the wisdom of the Book of Proverbs. And Blake was constantly worried about poor folks over there. So where the Bible's saying the Lord, I mean, here's another version of that law. The Lord will not suffer the soul of the righteous to famish, but he casteth away the substance of the wicked. Blake says, one law for the lion and ox is oppression. So what he's not just saying the opposite of what the law of distributive justice says. He's just saying any one law can't incorporate all wisdom. And that law itself can be the law of distributive justice is oppression. And I mean that's something that I agree. Then here's a whole bunch of others that Blake is just doing slight things to. He that watereth shall be watered also himself. 11:25. Blake says, dip him in the river who loves water. Now they're saying more or less the same thing. What's the difference there? Is there, I mean, how would you characterize that difference? We're down to 5 minute summary time, so, well, I might be able to answer that. I don't know. I mean, part of it is, I mean, just the phrasing. Blake's is a command. The biblical one is stated as a law, as an external law. But, I mean, that's not a very adequate summary of what Blake's up to. The next one, a wise king scattereth the wicked and bringeth the wheel over them. So, God smashes the wicked, kings should do the same thing. Blake says, drive your cart to plow over the bones of the dead. He gets rid of the moral framework, good and bad, and what he ends up with is alive and dead. I mean, his whole focus is everything that lives is holy. I mean, life is what's good. And life is not just talking about biological living, but imaginative life. So, if you're imaginatively dead, get rid of them. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of holy is understanding. Blake says everything that lives is holy. And just a couple more, and I want to get to his infernal read. There be three things which are too wonderful for me. I like this one in the Bible. Yea, four which I know not. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. So that's one of those riddle proverbs. I mean, and it's quite different from a lot of the others. I don't understand these things. Blake's response, when thou seest an eagle, thou seest a portion of genius, lift up your head. And another version, the roaring of lions, the howling of wolves, the raging of the stormy sea, and the destructive sword are portions of eternity too great for the eye of man. Now, let me just make one summary comment of part of the transformation that Blake is up to there, because I'm going to be out of time here quickly. The biblical proverb itself is a fairly traditional mythic statement. I mean, at least the way I read that. I mean, you can see there's this dualism implied there. There's spiritual stuff and there's material stuff. And the way of true wisdom is when those two are brought together. So it's, I don't understand eagles flying in the air is an archetypal symbol for the spiritual aspect of things. I don't understand serpents on rocks. I mean, the serpent, mythically, is always, I mean, it's the animal who's most tied to the material world. No part of its body is off it. So the speaker's saying, I don't understand spirit, I don't understand the material world, and I don't understand when the two are brought together. That is, the ship in the midst of a sea, so the water is the sign of the spirit or the unconscious, or a man with a woman. So basically what that proverb is saying, I don't claim that I understand anything. And Blake's, I mean, you can see, I mean, he really is thinking about that proverb, at least it seems like that to me, especially in the second one. The roaring of lions, howling of wolves, the raging of the stormy sea, and the destructive sword, portion of eternity, too great for the eye of man. What Blake's focusing on there is articulations, vocalizations. The biblical one isn't talking about vocalizations, it's talking about animals, objects. Blake's talking about speech, and that's what gets us down to the heart of the matter. Blake is constantly thinking about speech, the function of speech, and he always has in his mind when he writes anything, the opening lines to the book of John, Gospel of John, which quoted for me somebody. How does John begin?
What's the word?
That mystery is at the heart of the mystery for Blake. In speech, God is somehow connected with speech. We know that from these mythic frames. We'll try to deal with that later. God, Lady Wisdom, you know, those are weird myths. One way to think about that. But God and wisdom, God and speech go together. And we know from the parables, Jesus says, I mean, if you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could move mountains. Now, what does that mean? For Blake, it means some very specific things. I'm going to skip this one. And that's interesting too, but it gets down to more details. Remember, I use that term for biblical proverbs, affirmative utterances. Biblical proverbs are affirmative utterances. That, for Blake, is always going to lead to institutionalized law and oppression. And the term which is useful for defining Blake's view of, go ahead, of words and wisdom is the performative utterance. Say, okay, if you remember that. They're not affirmative utterances, they're performative utterances. Now, just very quickly, a performative utterance is a word that does something, that performs the act of doing something in the act of saying it. There's all kinds of human versions of this, so when a king decrees a law, I decree that this.
It happens. God speaking is the ultimate performative utterance. When God says in Genesis, let there be light, he's not just describing something. God is saying a performative utterance, proof light exists. Blake's wisdom, Blake's proverbs, the way he'll view proverbs, are as performative utterances, so that the force, the authority for the speech does come from the individual will of the speaker, not from summarizing collective wisdom. You say, okay, if you sort of get that, the way Blake sort of illustrates that and deals with that in his work is endlessly fascinating. I don't have time to talk about that today, but I'll talk more about it tomorrow. But what he'll do is that proverbs in Blake's work function then as language bombs. Whenever a proverb shows up, it's not just describing some traditional wisdom from the past. It's creating that wisdom instantly by fiat. So, and Blake will explore that sort of God talking and it happens. I mean, he would say that's what God does, that's what the Bible is, and then that's therefore what a good poet does. Jesus was a poet, and that's what he was doing. He was creating speech acts that could bring about, I mean, if continued to be viewed in the right way, they could bring about the feast, so that the foretaste of the feast to come won't just be a matter of looking at the menu for it and reading the Gospels, that it will actually happen before your very eyes. So the next work we'll look at is one of Blake's sort of apocalyptic works. Anyway, so what Blake hopes is after he's sort of paired up his proverbs with other biblical proverbs, pretty soon you'll start to read the Bible in a different fashion. So here's some other biblical ones right there. Where no counsel is, the people fall, but in the multitude of counselors, there's safety. There's a prudent proverb from the Bible. You can see how Blake's going to read that, and he'll say, that's exactly true. Where there's no counsel, there's no wisdom, people will fall. But where there's too many bad counselors, there's safety. But safety or prudence isn't what he's ultimately after. Or, how about down here, a fool despises his father's instruction, but he that regardeth reproof is prudent. Bible saying that, saying be prudent. Blake reads that with his definition of prudence and saying, right. A fool despises his father's instruction, but he that regardeth reproof is prudent, that is an ugly old maid courted by incapacity. Yeah, a fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it in till afterward. With Blake's reversals of definitions of folly and wisdom, a fool utters his mind. Or when you get down to, I like this one, at the bottom there. Rules of wisdom are chains about thy neck. At the end, an introduction to the Bible says that, are decorative chains, beauty. And Blake's version, he draws pictures of this. People manacled and chained. That's what wisdom is. And he's saying, look, it's even being revealed here. And then you get to these. These don't even need fooling with. All the words of my mouth are in righteousness. They are plain to him that understandeth. That's one of the proverbs. And Blake just repeats it. Truth can never be told so as to be understood and not be believed. You don't need to fool around with that. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. That's exactly what he's talking about, Blake's definition of wisdom as a performative. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. Or another one, and this is really up Blake's alley, for as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. That's a version of the law of distributive justice that Jesus deals with as sort of a psychologization of it, that Blake likes. Open rebuke is better than secret love. That's the prophetic speech that Blake likes. Or in 29, where there is no vision, the people perish. Blake doesn't need to fool with that because that's true. What he says is, see, there is wisdom here, and the bad editors didn't get rid of all of it.